Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Paul Halpern, professor of physics at St. Joe's here in Philly. In addition to his scholarly work, he's written about, 18 books for the lay reader, or as some reviews say about this book, the educated lay reader. From works on Einstein and my hero, Richard Feynman, to cosmic wormholes and quantum labyrinths and synchronicity, and the ubiquitous Schrodinger's cat, perhaps to the chagrin of Schrodinger himself. His latest book is The Allure of the Multiverse, Extra Dimensions, Other Worlds, and Parallel Universes. It's published by Basic Books, one of my favorite publishers, and released just a couple of weeks ago. So the multiverse is by force everywhere, not just in the multiverse, but in popular culture, from the MCU, Doctor Strange, Spider-Man, Loki, and The Flash, which is DC, so it sucks. The Man in the High Castle, and Paul loves, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. But so why do we love the concept so much? You know, it can't be proved. It can't be disproved. Isn't this the opposite of science and something that really can't be debated with the bounds of that branch of human knowledge and exploration?
Well, I think we need to distinguish between the scientific ideas about the multiverse and the cultural ideas about the multiverse. And in common usage, multiverse refers to the idea of alternative selves, of walking through a portal and seeing, you know, an evil version of us, or such as in the Star Trek series, evil version of Spock, who's wearing a beard and looking really sinister. And movies play up on that interest and introduce alternative characters, such as in the Marvel universe, alternative versions of Spider-Man and so forth. Instead of Peter Parker, you have young Miles Morales, who comes from a very, very different background and is still bitten by a radioactive spider, but has a very distinct profile. Well, anyway, science doesn't really talk about that. Science looks at the multiverse in terms of two general areas. One is quantum physics, which is the physics of the very small, and the other is cosmology, which is the physics of the universe itself. And surprisingly, especially in the latter area, cosmology, researchers are starting to develop indirect tests to see if there might be other universes out there beyond observation today, but perhaps interacted with our universe in its distant past.
You know, it's funny. It's something when I've interviewed David Chalmers and Philip Goff and Donald Hoffman, and one of my favorites, I guess, would be, the Nobel laureate, Frank Wilczek, who discovered time crystals. A nice guy. But I searched and searched and searched. There's not one mention of the term solipsism in your book. And Feynman said so many knobs, as you say, need to be turned and tweaked in order to get this right. And he goes, okay, well, then we can't even talk about it. But solipsism, using Occam's razor, doesn't even require one tweak. It's just the easiest way to imagine it. Either I'm here and this is my universe, or you're there and it's your universe, in which case, paradoxically, that almost creates a multiverse of its own.
Well, a solipsism is a really interesting philosophical puzzle. And I never really formally studied philosophy, but I took an excellent course as an undergraduate at Temple University. And I think the way around solipsism is to make a kind of leap of faith that because everything we experience, we see other people experiencing, outwardly at least, we make the reasonable assumption that they're going through the same struggles we are. So it would be really odd if we find a need to eat, to sleep, to, you know, interact with others, and that's just a complete illusion, and everybody else doing the same is also part of the same illusion. It seems more logical, or, you know, talking about Occam's razor, more simple to think of at least everybody on Earth as sentient creatures, sentient beings like ourselves, and going through the same struggles. And it's also part of empathy. Now, beyond human life, it's hard to imagine life beyond ours, life on other planets. You know, even, you know, when you talk about other universes, imagining what could possibly be, you know, conditions on other universes. So there we have a human-centric perspective, and that is known as the anthropic principle, that we can need to tailor science on the basis of the fact that we know that we exist as conscious beings, and the universe must end up with a situation in which you have conscious beings such as ours.
Well, you know, being in the Goldilocks zone and all that, the one thing I've always thought of, which is the simplest way to portray the idea of the anthropic principle, is that ice floats. I mean, it's the easiest one because it's supposed to sink. It's a solid. Why doesn't it sink? If it sunk, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah, we'd be sunk. So that's pretty remarkable. If we lived in a world where ice sinks and we couldn't possibly access water during the winter, that everything was frozen over and so forth, then it would be much more challenging. So it's good that we have, you know, living seas that even if, well, the seas usually don't freeze over, but even if a river freezes over, we have beings, fish and so forth under the river that can thrive.
Yeah, it's funny because I was listening to your discussion with, I've forgotten the name of the gentleman, but it was your second time there, and you go, oh yeah, in 2 years, a lot of things have changed. And I was thinking, you passed the Turing test, I passed the Turing test, and so does GPT. So once GTP is in a body, it would pass the Turing test too, which either you or I might have already done that. That's why I kind of think that way.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, personally, I see things put out by GPT, and I still have a feeling that it's not quite right. So it's well written, but I don't get a sense that a person is behind it. But I'm sure there are people who would think that it's a person.
Yeah, well, we're not quite right either, but. But there, but going back to, you know, I jump all around and I apologize for that. But, you know, there's this other razor called Alder's razor or Newton's flaming laser sword. And it says, basically, if something cannot be settled by experiment or observation, then it's not worthy of debate. And I'm not saying you're a proponent of the multiverse, because that's the best thing about this book, is you present both sides of it, both from the history of science and the personalities that you delve in so well into so well. But why is it worthy of debate in the scientific community if it can't, it's non-falsifiable?
Well, that's very interesting, because classical physics up until the late 19th century, the emblem of it and the scientific method was falsifiability. But then we got into things like quantum physics, special relativity, general relativity. And there are areas in modern physics that are not directly observable. So they're falsifiable, but only indirectly. For example, in quantum physics, there's the famous uncertainty principle that you can measure the position of a particle and you can measure the velocity of the particle, but you can't do both at the same time. So then if you measure the position of a particle, you say, well, how do we know that it has velocity? Well, according to quantum physics, it doesn't really have a distinct velocity. It's kind of a blur. But then later, if we measure the velocity, the position is blurred out. So you might say, oh, well, I only believe in things which are directly observable, and you need to observe everything, every physical parameter at once. If you observe them separately, then that doesn't count. So then you run into a situation where not everything is completely verifiable, because if you repeat a quantum experiment, you might get different results, a different outcome probabilistically, So it's not really repeatable. It's more repeatable statistically. So it's statistically, if you run quantum experiments and you do it enough times, then there are particular outcomes, but not necessarily individually. So there's a relaxation in a way of that criteria. And similarly with cosmology, we make assumptions about the universe, but because of the speed of light, there are parts of the universe that are completely inaccessible. For example, if we go beyond something like 46 billion light years in radius, we have to only imagine that there must be galaxies out there and stars out there, but they're beyond not just observation now, but we can never observe them because there are parts of the universe that are forever beyond observation because it simply would take too long for the light to reach us at the speed of light, and we wouldn't be able to see them. So there are certainly unobservable aspects of science that people have accepted. So people who say, oh, the multiverse is the only thing in science that's non-observable or non-verifiable, that's not really correct.
Closest you come in your book to a verifiable aspect of the existence of multiverses is when you talk about the decay in the background radiation. There might be these little spots where it looks like, oh, well, maybe that was where it went. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, there are some researchers out there who are trying to find scars of bubble collisions. And this idea of eternal inflation is that our universe was seeded by some kind of quantum energy event, but there might be other events out there in which the energy is just right to cause the rapid expansion of space, which is known as inflation. And so if inflation happened in our part of the universe, maybe it happens again and again elsewhere. And instead of a single big bang, you have all these bubble universes out there that are all expanding. And it's possible that sometime in the past, one of the other bubble universes collided with our universe and created an imprint or scar. And that scar would be seen in the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is the leftover radio hiss from the Big Bang.
When you talk about the metaphor you use with regard to inflation is the idea that in less than a time, almost infinitesimal to us, the universe expanded from the size of a proton to the size of a baseball. How does that tie in to the, not only, well, it's not, doesn't really tie into the allure, but how does that tie into the science as well?
Well, it's just remarkable because, and I mentioned the baseball size, because it's remarkable to think that the universe has expanded so much since that time. So if we look backward from the present, we start with a universe that's billions and billions of light years big, which is enormous. We're talking about each light year is trillions of miles. And then we go all the way back in time and we see the observable universe being the size of a baseball. And that seems very drastic, but we're talking about 13.8 billion years for that to happen. But then before that, in a trillionth of a second, that baseball, if we go backward in time, was the size of a proton. So, and that is a much bigger change in a much shorter amount of time. So going from something that's subatomic to the size of a baseball is really mind-blowing if it happens in trillionths of a second. So that just gives you an idea of the scale of inflation and then the slow growth of the universe since then.
Well, that leads me to think about, tangentially, the collapse of the wave function and, of course, Schrodinger's cat, which you almost have to mention in every lay science book. But I was thinking in terms of other collapses or pretend. Suppose you had a friend from middle school and you used to text back and forth recently, maybe on Facebook, and then all of a sudden he ghosts you. No pun intended. And you then do not know whether he's alive or dead, especially in today's world. So until you observe by an obituary or someone calling you, he's both alive and dead in your own mind, correct? And that happens everywhere and all the time.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of ambiguity in life about our lack of knowledge of things. Schrodinger was pointing out this lack of ambiguity between life and death for something that we would think would be very easily be observable, just a cat in a box. You'd think you would know if a cat in a box is living or dead. And the idea that until the box is opened, the cat is in a mixed state of a living and dead, kind of a zombie-like mixture, is really mind-blowing. Of course, Schrödinger meant that as a kind of satire. He didn't really believe that the cat would be in a mixture of living and dead. And I don't think, if a friend goes to you, you wouldn't think that they were in a mixed state of living and dead. You might worry about them, like what happened to them, but you wouldn't expect them to be a zombie unless you maybe you're John Carpenter or one of these Hollywood. Imagine if Hollywood directors might imagine that they turned into a zombie.
Yeah, and the zombie thing is a big deal now because you see it everywhere. It's been like 20 years now since the zombie apocalypse became a meme.
I
The
guess I'm
interesting.
thinking of George Romero, right, with the Night of the Living
Right.
Dead.
The
Right,
B movie
yeah.
and the B movies.
Right.
Switching around, like I said, I'm want to do. The other interesting thing about the book is when I started reading it, because you started with movies and stuff, I said, oh, this is going to be like another one of those books which you can just pick up and go through and you're entertained and amused. But then you get into the real science of it. And all of a sudden, when it's Niels Bohr and Feynman, I'm going, oh, this is great. Because that's when you really want to dive into it. That was so cool about the book. But why don't you give, because you start with Pythagoras. Well, you don't start with him, but you talk Aristotle, the ancients, and we all kind of know of them. But then you get into someone like Auguste Blanchi, and it's no one knows who he is. And I wondered how you, it's almost chronological. Well, it is chronological the way you do it. So take us a little bit through. You can't do all the scientists, but pick up some of the highlights of how you decided this is the way that the concept of the multiverse, especially when you're talking about a real, almost a religious concept that the first time the word was coined. Talk to us a little bit about how you went through that process.
Well, I think I decided, based upon some of my previous books, not to spend too much time with the really old stuff, but I felt like it deserved a chapter. So I devoted the first chapter after the introduction to really everything before the 20th century. And the main focus was on two characters, Louis Blanqui and Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche is better known because of his philosophy and his idea of Übermensch or Superman. And Blanqui, I never heard of until a couple years ago when I was invited to write a scholarly paper about a Latin American author who referred to Blanqui in his writings. And I was kind of like, who's this? And I looked up his work, and he was very innovative, even though he was basically a revolutionary and spent most of his life in prison. He used the time in prison to be very imaginative and to think about all these worlds out there, and perhaps worlds that are just like Earth with some slight variations, which seemed kind of multiverse-like, even though it didn't talk about other universes. It was mainly talking about other Earths. And I harked back there to the idea of Giordano Bruno's saying, this, and this was considered heresy at the time, saying that there are infinite number of worlds out there, there's an infinite number of beings. And that was one of the reasons he was condemned by the Roman Inquisition and sentenced to death and burned at the stake, which was horrific, of course. And for the crime, one of his crimes was postulating other worlds.
Yeah. Galileo didn't have it so bad because it was just house arrest, but he did say, and still, but still it moves. So he got that zinger in there before they locked him up. So.
Galileo was very well connected. So he was friends of the Florentine royalty, in a sense, the Medici family, who were a prominent banking family. So he had connections in high places. So I think they were trying to set an example with him with the house arrest, but they also knew that this was a very, very prominent person and that there might be a public outrage if something happened to him.
The most prosaic, if you will, but perhaps most apt reference in the book is to the movie Sliding Doors with Gwyneth Paltrow. And that really does set up, first, the likability of the idea, the allure of the idea, which is the book title, of, you know, that if I had just brushed my teeth for 1 second less, that tree wouldn't have hit me in the head. Or it's almost predeterminism that everything you do in your life is led to that moment when the safe falls on your head. But, or go ahead and talk about how you talk about the relationship changing for Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yes, well, that is one of my favorite movies about with a multiverse theme. And it's really remarkable because cinematography, it's excellent. I rewatched it recently I wrote an article, my top 10 favorite movies about the multiverse, which is also out there. But anyway, it was kind of remarkable because it shows her running down the steps to a subway train, and then a little kid blocks her way, and then she just misses the train, and then the camera has everything go backward for a time, and then she does the same thing again, unknowing that she's already done this, and then the mother of the child pulls the child out of the way, and she manages to make the train, and the film shows what happens to her relationship with her boyfriend, and what happens to the idea of meeting a new guy in her life, who's presented as kind of Mr. Right. Your boyfriend's presented as Mr. Wrong, and people are rooting for her to end up with the good boyfriend rather than the bad boyfriend. And interestingly, there are a lot of parallels between the two branches. There are differences, key differences, but also key parallels. And you really have to wait till the end of the movie to find out which branch is better.
Yeah, and the other thing, going to books, and one of my favorite authors, because at 12 years old, you were probably doing the same thing, is The Sound of Thunder by Ray Bradbury. Talk a little bit about that, because it kind of is the same thing, but kind of isn't.
Yeah, Bradbury was real genius in terms of coming up with science fiction ideas. And I was a big fan of his too when I was a kid. And The Sound of Thunder imagines time travelers going back in time and having a safari in which they try to hunt dinosaurs using, you know, these guns, and they deliberately only fire at the dinosaurs that are going to die anyway, because they don't want to change history. So that's how they get their kicks in the future, because there aren't any other game animals, and, you know, you can't really do it in the present because there aren't these wild game animals. So dinosaurs are, you know, for people who want to show off and show how brave they are. And while going back in time, they're supposed to stay on a special path to avoid any possibility of changing history. But then the lead character is a coward, and he runs off the path and steps on a butterfly. And by stepping on the butterfly, that ends up changing history in a fundamental way. And, you know, including the English language, and including a very close presidential election in which, instead of the good guy winning, the bad guy wins instead. And since the days of Bush versus Gore, we're all too used to close presidential elections.
Yeah, and the president he comes back to, and I specifically remember the poster of him when you said things have changed in 2 years, you're kind of coming back to the wrong side, in my opinion. You don't have to go into politics, but because when you go into politics, it affects the sales of your books.
No, I'm not. I'm completely neutral on everything.
Sure you are.
Yes, right. Okay. No, I mean, I've been pretty lucky on social media. A lot of people are interested in my books and interested in my ideas and science. And I know that they range all across the political spectrum, and that's really nice. It's nice to have free speech, as long as it's not mean free speech, but as long as it's friendly free speech where people are putting across ideas.
Yeah, it's like when you end that one talk saying, promoting yourself, or you say, you know, you can find me on Twitter, Twitter/X, even if some of you don't, you know, that was good. I enjoyed listening to that.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, of course, some people left Twitter with the new CEO being there, who's managed to create a certain amount of controversy. And, you know, so, and for me, not to get into politics, but I recognize that in our country, our society, a lot of companies have CEOs and we don't always agree with their positions. And that's why I really believe in a democracy of positions where people who are not so wealthy get to state their points of view. So I'd rather not even worry about what CEOs' points of view are. I'm more interested in what ordinary people's points of view are.
Yeah. In that particular case, though, you're talking about one, the most important man of the 21st century, at the same time as the bifurcation of his personality versus the absolutely amazing things he's done, for which sometimes he doesn't get any credit, which might be the reason why his personality is skewed. But that's as far away from your book as I will get.
Yeah, I'm not really going to delve into that because I tend to value, my values in life are culture, arts, literature. So I don't really look at wealth as, you know, I don't look at it as something that makes people better or worse. It's, I look at, you know, a talent, you know, things like people who are excellent writers, people who are excellent artists, musicians, and so forth, as a way to, you know, decide who's more interesting.
Yeah, well, there's not too many people that can land two boosters at the same time either. But in any event, so there was another short story by Robert Heinlein, because I think you talk about Tesseracts, and it was called "And He Built a Crooked House." Did you ever read that one?
Yes. So that is really interesting look at the fourth dimension, and pretty scary when, you know, there's a wall in the house or a door in the house that empties up into absolute nothingness. So
didn't that
one of the other stories that affected me as a kid, like the idea.
Didn't that one window really get to you at that moment in the book? It was like,
oh yeah, that was pretty scary to imagine this window going off into like weird alien space. So anyway, even if I could afford an architect, I would not have a Tesseract house built because, you know, it'd be pretty scary.
I wouldn't do it in San Francisco anyway.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. But Robert Heinlein was another great author. And I have to mention, if we're talking about science fiction, I was very influenced by Isaac Asimov, who I saw speak in person, which was one of the highlights of my youth. He came to Philadelphia and I saw him give a talk, and he sat upon what looked like a giant throne and looked very much like scientific royalty. And then spoke a bit and then answered questions. And I asked him, I forget exactly what I asked him, but I asked him something about black holes. And that's all I remember about the question and the answer. But I was just delighted to interact with him. I never got a picture of myself with Asimov. I kind of regret that.
Yeah, I did the same thing with Kurt Vonnegut, and I didn't get a picture with him either. And Kurt Vonnegut was another one who kind of posited a lot of the things.
Yeah, yeah. Slaughterhouse-Five, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I would have liked to have met him.
Yeah, he was cool, but he was like Mark Twain, you know, he's kind of mean and acerbic, but at the same time, incredibly humorous. And Asimov was very arrogant to a certain extent, but he deserved to be. I mean, if you think you're prolific, think of him, my God.
Oh, yeah. I always think, like, if I wanted to catch up with him, he wrote like 500 books. So yeah. I'm going to have to live to like 1,000 years or something to finish that, to catch up with that record.
You might have done it in some other universe. I don't know. You might have written.
Yeah, I think it's harder to get published now than was back then. There weren't that many competitors. There weren't that many science writers. And also Asimov was, I mean, he had very few distractions. I think he just sat in his apartment and with his typewriter and just typed all the time and very rarely went out and gave talks.
Yeah, all the way from Shakespeare to iRobot.
Yeah.
So if you talk about like, well, there was another one I was gonna another book I was gonna mention. But if you get back to I mean, there's so many topics I could talk about. Unfortunately, I talk too much. But the other one I was thinking about was, again, like you and I both really admire Feynman, and you've actually written lots of stuff about him. But if you talk about Feynman diagrams, that's also a good way to access one of the big themes of your book. So talk a little bit about what he did and what it means in the sum over histories kind of concept.
Yeah, so I sometimes call Feynman's concept a multiverse in a bottle, because it's like you have these alternative histories, but it's like you kind of don't know that they're there until you unplug the bottle and you see the outcome. So what happens is, when electrons interact in the classical model, the electrons just follow one trajectory when interacting, like one path. And Feynman said, well, to imagine the quantum picture, we imagine that they travel every possible path, and that somehow there's a blending of all these possibilities, a probabilistic blending. So I like to say it's like, if somebody is traveling between two places, commuting, let's say they commute from Exton to Philadelphia every day, and you say, well, how do you go? And they say, well, I take the train and I drive and I take a bus and I take an Uber and I get a ride from someone else. And you're like, hey, wait a minute, like, which of those things do you do? The train, driving? They say, oh, I do all those things at once. And that's what an electron's commute is like. It does everything at once. And somehow the outcome is a smear of all those possibilities. And that's called the sum over histories idea.
And it's funny, like the idea of standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, you talk about Newtonian, and then you move on to Einstein, and then like Max Planck and the quantum world and Feynman. And why, how is it that this all meshes together in your head and in your writing? Because it seems, again, to the layman, like these are four completely different things.
Well, it's the development of the transition between deterministic physics, where you have everything's objective, which is the Newtonian reality. Everything is measurable, everything is reproducible. And then you go into the old quantum physics with Max Planck and original ideas by Einstein, like the photoelectric effect, where you have some jumpiness. And but you, then you say, well, the jumpiness is just a statistical effect or some weird effect, because you don't know everything, but if you knew everything, you would still have smoothness and objectivity. And then finally, you reach the 1920s, where people like Schrödinger and Heisenberg come up with equations for quantum mechanics. And then you realize that there's like a fundamental blurring and the fundamental lack of knowledge in quantum mechanics. And then in Feynman's day, that becomes looking at a blurriness of paths and histories. And I would argue that that led through the work of John Wheeler to the beginnings of multiverse ideas through people like Hugh Everett.
That some of that involves the concept of infinity, which leads to positing for the existence of a multiverse, that anything that has happened will happen now and then happen again and happen infinitely in identical configurations or almost exact configurations, which leads a little bit, if you want to explain, which you do really well in the book, and he also seems to be one of your favorites, is the Hilbert Hotel.
Yeah, well, Hilbert was a great mathematician, very well-known mathematician, and he tried to formalize all of mathematics in, he wrote books on the fundamentals of algebra and geometry and so forth. And his main foil, intellectual foil, was Kurt Gödel, who said, oh, there always has to be some questions that have unknown answers. such as the question is, if you say this sentence is false, that statement, is it true or false? If you say it's true, then it must be false. If you say it's false, then it must be true. So there are paradoxical statements that logic cannot resolve. But Hilbert was very interested in the basis of quantum mechanics, and he coined the idea of Hilbert space, which is an infinite dimensional space that can accommodate all the possibilities for quantum states. So if an electron has an unlimited number of positions, then each position is represented by a different dimension in Hilbert space. And that only upon measurement does this blend of positions collapse down to a single position. So that is John von Neumann, the brilliant Hungarian mathematician's interpretation of quantum mechanics, is that before measurement, you have this unlimited Hilbert space, and then after measurement, it collapses down to one of its dimensions. And I also mentioned the Hilbert hotel, which is an analogy Hilbert used to talk about infinite spaces.
Yeah. Then I guess for people who don't know, very briefly, how would I get a room there?
Well, the interesting thing is, if you drive up to the Hilbert Hotel, it always has a no vacancy sign on because all the rooms are full. But then, you know, don't give up, because you pull into the office and you say, well, I saw your no vacancy sign. Do you have a room? And the answer is always yes, because if it's one person coming in, checking in, they say, well, all right, we'll move the person in room one to room two, person in room two to room three, all the way down the line. And then that frees up room one for your lodging. And even if you come in with an infinite group of friends, they can always accommodate, because then they can just switch all the people to even rooms. And then the odd rooms open up for you and your friends.
And it's funny, because that reminds me, when you say Kurt Gödel, I was thinking of Bertrand Russell and Alfred Lord Whitehead and Principia Mathematica, and how I think Bertrand Russell said, after I was done, my brain was never the same. He broke his brain. But Kurt Gödel and others, after he was done thinking he did all this amazing thing, they proved him he was wrong. So that harkens back to me, again, in an offhand way, to Alan Turing, because the whole idea of the Turing machine is what it's supposed to replicate the universe, but it can't, because it would be bigger than the universe in order to replicate it in the first place. And
yeah,
that touches upon your book too, although I don't know how, just in my mind it does.
Well, it's interesting, because the old computers used Turing's idea, which is now known as bits, ones and zeros. So you can represent everything by ones and zeros. But the new form of computers, quantum computers, use qubits. And instead of binary ones and zeros, they represent blended states. And they're kept in a state of superposition, kind of like the Schrodinger's cat being kept in a state of a mixture of live and dead. And they remain in that state until the computation is complete.
So it's the measurement itself that creates the ability for qubits to make a determination as to what the answer is.
Yes, at the measurement, that's when you have the decoherence. So you start off with a coherent state, which is only possible, unfortunately, with ultra low temperatures. So quantum computers are very expensive, because they have to be kept at a fraction of a degree Kelvin, which is a degree above, fraction of a degree above absolute zero.
Well, once we get them cold enough, and once we come up with cold fusion, and once AI gets advanced, you and I probably aren't going to be around, or our descendants will not either.
Yeah, well, I expect that someday publisher will commission books by AI. It might not be too far in the future, but I really believe in human creativity, and I'm a strong believer in do it yourself and, you know, use your own brain to do things. Ironically, even though, you know, I write about science and technology, I'm a very, on most things, by today's standards, I'm a very low tech person. So
what about the idea of, okay, suppose AI, I mean, I could ask GPT to write a story in the style of Paul Halpern, but and eventually it'll get really good at it. What do you think? It's almost a spiritual question. What do you think it is that's the spark in you that will always be different, or not better, but always have that element that it can't replicate? What is that, if it is a spark?
Well, when I'm really into writing, I kind of like the idea of like waking up, and I almost, it's not like a dream, but sometimes I wake up with whole paragraphs in my head about, or whole ideas in my head about something to write down. And I grab a piece of paper and write it down on paper. And usually that's some of my more creative passages just kind of pop into my brain. So I kind of, you can call that the muse, which is a poetic way of talking about it. But I find that's really kind of amazing, this idea that things can just pop up in your head through inspiration. But I'm wondering if that might be kind of a lost art, because you need a lot of concentration for that. And unfortunately, in today's society, a lot of people are distracted all the time and don't take the time to, you know, just think reflectively about things.
You have to write it down as soon. Do you wake up in the middle of the night and write it down? I can't wait till the morning and write it down because it's gone, you know?
Well, if I wake up and I'm conscious enough to think of some paragraphs for my book, that usually means I need to get up and walk around a little bit. And then I'll just find a slip of paper, like an envelope or scrap paper, and write it down. Sometimes, you know, I have enough patience to type it into my computer, but sometimes it's just grab a pencil, grab a piece of paper. But it could be while I'm driving, just find a piece of scrap paper in the glove compartment or something. So, but most of my writing is not like that. Most of my writing is just sitting with my laptop at a coffee shop or someplace like that, and just like start writing about a topic. It just, that's more like I have to kind of think about the topic. It doesn't always come like naturally or pop into my head.
Yeah, I just interviewed someone recently who talked about that and was talking about when you're driving, you have all these thoughts in your head, and then you realize, I don't know what I've been doing for the past 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's true. Especially if you're on a commute and you like leave your house, and then suddenly you're arriving at your destination, and like your brain is kind of on autopilot in terms of the driving aspect.
That's why I couldn't listen to you, your audiobook, because I would drive past my exit. I've done it many times.
Yeah, I'm really bad at multitasking. And if someone's in the car and engaged in like a really deep conversation, sometimes I will miss an exit or go the wrong way or something like that. But, you know, but music is fine. Music helps me concentrate.
Yeah, me too. I always studied to music. Well, before we conclude, well, I guess in conclusion, and it's totally, again, off the wall because I'm coming back to something we spoke about, but one of your favorite movies, I can't remember whether you mentioned it in the book or not, is Run Lola Run. And to me, for some reason, that was the most poignant of all of those. And I don't know why. Mm-hmm. You feel the same way, kind of?
I saw that, I have to confess, rather recently when I was putting together my list of the top 10 multiverse movies. And I saw that on another list, and I thought, and I mentioned it to a friend of mine. He said, oh yeah, that's a great movie, let's watch it together. So we saw it together, and I really liked it. And that was really cool, because you have three opportunities to complete a task, and two of them end up, you know, really bad failures, like one of the characters dies, and then the third time is a charm.
Yeah. And you like cinematography, and that had excellent cinematography.
Yeah, and also like it was very subtle. Unfortunately, with a lot of American movies and American TV series, they have to spell out everything exactly. And there it was very subtle, because you had this you know, this car she's running, and she, you know, kind of like runs past a car that's sort of in an accident, and then in one case the car makes it, and that changes all of the history of everything that happens, because the car has someone who's going to meet with her father. So it really changes things.
And the other thing about it, unlike the MCU, which relies essentially on effects, it was character that drove, it was character and just two people going back and forth. So that was one of the reasons, I guess, that poignancy occurred with my review of it.
Yeah. Although the MCU maybe should buy the rights to make a sequel, and they can have like a super Lola character that was born on another planet and has ultra different power, mega powers. Might improve the movie. Maybe not.
Well, your book is almost cinematic. They can make a movie out of that.
That's a good idea. Find a producer.
Okay. I'll ask my cinematographer. He loves doing stuff like that. Okay. Well, I guess in real conclusion, because me being as talkative as I am, I go through several conclusions, kind of like a multiverse. But the last thing I'll ask you is, because, for want of a better word, it's like a lay science book, but because it's so intelligent and goes into so much depth, what is it that you want? And I'm lucky at my bookstore because I have a lot of intelligent lay readers. What is it that you would want someone to take away from this, and then where to go after they, because there's so many rabbit holes you could go down.
Well, I want them to know the distinction between, you know, their cultural idea of the multiverse and the science, but also the importance of the science that's going on, even though it's sort of, there's a lot of hypothetical ideas out there, but I think it's important to have some sense of the value of science, and that some of the ideas out there are weird, but you never know when a weird idea might turn out to be correct. Like black holes, when they were first proposed, were considered, you know, very fanciful, and no one knew if they could really find a black hole. Similarly, in the 19th century, the fourth dimension was considered something really weird and maybe something spiritual, mystical, and now it's part of ordinary physics. So you never know when something speculative will turn out to be real.
Right. And the best thing about the book is you're not implying or forcing the reader to accept a conclusion on your part. You're allowing the reader to go ahead and decide on his or her own which way to go.
Yeah, I tend to be in my writing pretty agnostic about certain ideas, just from the point of view that, you know, I'm not a super active researcher. I've done some research, but I don't have a stake in saying, well, this idea is the correct idea and all the other ideas are nonsense. Like some, you know, high-powered theorists might be more of an advocate for their own ideas.
Yes, as many of the authors I've read, especially when I ask them about solipsism. Well, in any event, thank you so much, Paul. It's been a pleasure. And as I said earlier, whenever you can get the opportunity to come out to Wellington Square Bookshop, I'd love to have you there.
Thank you, Sam. I'd love to come out and visit and, you know, tour the store.
Okay. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
You're very welcome. Take care.
You too.